This particular lesson came from staff meetings at Barry's Chapel from June the 12th of 2001 through February the 19th of 2002. We were studying the book of Proverbs, and I began to notice how often Solomon talked about reproof and correction and rebuke, and it just jumped out, and I started circling those. And then I guess it was the next year, I had what I call a week in isolation. It's weeks that I've taken three times just to spend a week studying. I go by myself to an isolated place and get up in the morning at 8 o'clock, walk 30 minutes, shower, shave, start studying at 6, start studying at 8, study till 10 o'clock at night. And so I spent part of this particular week going back through the book of Proverbs, reading these verses, studying the words, and putting this together. And so that's where this came from. Honest criticism is hard to take, particularly from a relative, a friend, an acquaintance, or a stranger. I went to Central Church of Christ in Dalton, Georgia in April 1977. The two custodians there were often helpful to me. I don't know if you know it or not, but a lot of times people write notes and leave them on the pews and on the floor. When they would pick up things that were interesting, they would pass them on to me. So in November of 1977, here's something. It was on a 4x6 card. This is a copy of it. Here's what it says. Our preacher is too young, too immature, too trite. I get nothing from his services, and now he is my Sunday school teacher, too. That may be something for the class upstairs to be worried about here in a few weeks when I go up there and start teaching. What is interesting is that this 4x6 card was attached to a ballpoint pen with the person's name engraved on it. I returned her pen and kept the comment. 1995, I put together a series of classes called God's Great Servants Leadership Training. We plan to start these in August on Wednesday night for men training to be elders and deacons. Anybody who is an elder or deacon or would like to be an elder or deacon who knows an elder or deacon, any man in those categories. And what we encourage people to do is to write down every man that you think might be a good elder or deacon somewhere in the next 3 months to the next 30, 40 years, somewhere in that span. And then I send a card of invitation and ask them if they would like to participate, and they reply. Here's the reply that I received dated December 9, 1999. Jerry, I will be perfectly honest with you. I am not, nor will I ever be interested in becoming a leader at this church. I am not interested in your class. I once was a deacon at this church, but have no good memories, only bad ones. People never satisfied, always complaining. I've experienced much the same in my personal life. That's why I'd rather dig the ditch and let someone else get the praise. Thanks for your understanding. I was so excited when I got that I called the man up and I said, thank you for writing a wonderful letter to me. It tells the impact of what criticism can do to a person. And I asked the privilege of having lunch with this man and talking about it further. And we were able to do that, and it was powerful to hear some of the background of that. And I said, I do leadership workshops from time to time, and I'd like to share what you did with others. I'll promise you two things. Number one, I'll never use your name. Number two, I won't use it at Barry's Chapel. And here's what he said. He said, you can use it at Barry's Chapel. You can use my name. I don't care who knows it. That's the way I feel. Well, I'm going to use his name, but isn't that powerful on what criticism does to people? Well, let's look in the Bible at some people who were criticized. Exodus chapter 5, Moses and Aaron goes up to Pharaoh and says, let my people go. And Pharaoh's not too impressed. He says, you've got too much time on your hands. You're going to have the same input-output of brick, but you're going to have to start getting the raw materials yourself. We're not going to furnish them to you. You're going to have to provide the straw. And so the taskmasters go to Pharaoh and beg for mercy. And Pharaoh said, you're idle. And so the officers who had been to talk to Pharaoh were coming back, and they're talking to Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them. Then they said, let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and the sight of his servants to put a sword in their hand to kill us. Literally, you're making us stink in the sight of Pharaoh. And we don't like what you're doing. Chapter 14, verses 1 through 12. The plagues are over. The people are leaving Israel. They pass through the sea. And they look around, and here comes Pharaoh's army. Verse 10, Exodus 14. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is not this the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. They're criticizing Moses and Aaron. Are they the good guys or the bad guys? Good guys, but they're getting severe criticism, and it gets worse. Numbers chapters 13 and 14. In Numbers 13, Moses sends out those 12 spies, Shemua, Shaphat, Agopalti, Gadiel, Gadai, Ammin, Nabi, Sheul, Joshua, and Caleb. You remember them, probably talked about them at breakfast this morning. And he said, I want you to go into the land. I want you to tell me what kind of cities they have. Are they protected or unprotected? What kind of people are there? Tell me about the land. And they came back and said, the land is flowing with milk and honey. However, there's a problem. They are giants and we're grasshoppers and we can't do it. Joshua and Caleb said, let's go up at once. Let's go up at once and take the land. Here's what the people said, chapter 14, Numbers. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in the wilderness. Why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let's select a leader and return to Egypt. They said, we don't like our leaders and we don't like the direction they're taking us. Well, Joshua and Caleb, they'd been over there. They said, it's a land flowing with milk and honey. The Lord will be with us and we can take it. Verse 10, then all the congregation said to stone them with stones. That's criticism. When you start throwing rocks at folks, that's criticism. Well, aren't you glad we don't live under the Old Testament? We can take... Let's go to the New Testament and see how it is. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 10, speaking of Paul. Paul, one of the good guys, one of the bad guys. Good guys. They said, his letters, they say, are weighty and powerful, but his speech is contemptible and his bodily presence weak. In everyday language, they said he's ugly and he can't preach. Well, yeah, I mean, Jerry, but maybe we can just be good enough. Maybe we can try hard enough that we won't get criticism. Well, that's a possibility if you can be better than Jesus Christ. Listen to what they said about him in Mark 3, verse 22. And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem said, he has Beelzebub, and by the ruler of the demons he cast out demons. John 10, verse 20, they said he's got a demon and he's going crazy. That's what's said about Jesus. Well, yeah, I mean, okay. I mean, you know, the devil is going to oppose you, but surely we can be good enough that you know, the good folks won't criticize us. Well, you could wish that, but let's go back to Mark chapter 3, verses 20 and 21, speaking about Jesus again. Then the multitude came together again so that they could not so much as eat bread, but when his own people heard about this, they went out to lay hold of him, for they said, he is out of his mind. That's his kin folks. Now, if Jesus couldn't be good enough and work hard enough for his own kin folks not to think he's crazy, guess what? We're probably going to get some criticism. And if that's true, maybe one of the best things that we could do, rather than wish it wouldn't happen, is to learn how to deal with it. At least I came to that conclusion several decades after I resisted it and resisted it and resisted it. A preacher was talking to one of his preacher friends on a Monday, And he was talking about the severe criticism that he got on Sunday. And rather than being whiny and sympathetic, his preacher friend said, "Well, praise the Lord, that's one woe off your back." He said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, Jesus said in Luke 6:26, woe to you when all men speak well of you, for so did their fathers to the false prophets." So all men are not speaking well of you, and that's one woe off your back. You don't have to worry about that anymore. Okay, let's start with our Proverbs criticism sandwich. The reason we call it a sandwich, we're going to get a slice of bread from Psalms 139:23-24. "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxieties, and see if there's any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." One translation says, "Point out any weakness in me." Let me ask you a question. Do you think that would be a good prayer for me and you to pray today? Ask God, "God, just look inside and see if you find anything wrong. If you do, let's straighten it out." Is that good? Is that good? I think it's a pretty good prayer. Question, how do you believe God's going to do that? That's a good prayer. How's God going to answer that prayer? Let me tell you what he has not done to me. He may do it to you every day, but he doesn't do it to me. I've been running 41 years, and each morning when I get through with my run, I have what I call a realignment talk. I get out of line pretty often. And so while I'm cooling down, I got about a 2.5-minute talk that I give to myself. And it's verses from the Bible and a poem or two and some sayings that have been really encouraging to me. And I end it with this one right here. "Search me, O God, know my heart. Try me, know my anxieties. See if there's any wicked way in me. Lead me in the way everlasting." I have not had the people in Woodland Forest Subdivision in Nashville, Tennessee to say, "Jerry, I wish you'd quit running in the morning and asking God to point out all your faults. Because this booming voice comes up every morning, just shakes the whole hill, and it wakes us up. I'm tired of God talking to you like that." He's never done that. So if he doesn't do it that way, how do you think God is going to point out what needs to happen? Well, he does it in the Bible. But one of the ways he's done it to me, he's had some folks who come and say, "Jerry, need to talk to you. Need to talk to you." And so that's at least a possibility. See, I believe that anybody who finds salmonella in my refrigerator and tells me about it is not my enemy, they're my friend. Don't want my kids and grandkids to get sick, and so they say, "Hey, you got disease in the refrigerator. Need to clean out your refrigerator. Thank you very much. Appreciate you telling me that. Save me going to the doctor and getting sick." Someone said maturity is moving from a thin skin and a hard heart to a thick skin and a soft heart. Bill Gates said, "Your most unhappy customers are your greatest source of learning." Proverbs 1:23-31 is wisdom personified talking. Wisdom, as if wisdom were a person, is talking to Solomon's son, and here's what wisdom says. "If only you had listened when I corrected you, I would have told you what's in my heart. I would have told you what I'm thinking. I called, but you refused to listen. I held out my hand, but you paid no attention. So you did not follow my advice and did not listen when I corrected you. So I will laugh when you're in trouble. I'll make fun when disaster strikes you. When disaster comes over you like a storm, when trouble strikes you like a whirlwind, when pain and trouble overwhelm you, then you will call to me, but I will not answer. You will look for me, but you will not find me. It is because you rejected knowledge and did not choose to respect the Lord. You did not accept my advice and you rejected my correction. So you'll get what you deserve. You will get what you planned for others." He said, if you don't like it, it's going to be tough, but it's your choice. Proverbs 3:11-12, "My child, don't reject the Lord's discipline and don't be upset when he corrects you, for the Lord corrects those he loves, just as a father corrects a child in whom he delights." Proverbs 5:7-12 is the father talking to his son about an immoral woman. He said, "Now my sons, listen to me and don't ignore what I say. Stay away from such a woman. Don't even go near the door of her house. Or you will give your riches to others, and the best years of your life will be given to someone cruel. Strangers will enjoy your wealth, and what you work so hard for will go to someone else. You will groan at the end of your life when your health is gone. Then you will say, I hated being told what to do. I would not listen to correction. Proverbs 9, 7 to 9 talks about how response tells the kind of person we are. Response to correction. Anyone who rebukes a mocker will get an insult in return. Anyone who corrects the wicked will get hurt. So don't bother correcting mockers. They will only hate you. But correct the wise and they will love you. Instruct the wise and they will be even wiser. Teach the righteous and they will learn even more. Well, I'll tell you what I do when somebody corrects me. I just give it right back to them. He said, yep, that's what a mocker will do. He'll get a smart retort in return. But a wise person will say, thank you for caring enough to share your thoughts and feelings with me. Edwin Friedman has written some books that have just been powerful to me. Here's a comment in one of his books. He said, I've been discussing with a client who had worked through some very difficult problems what distinguished those who succeed in changing their life course. Since he was a former boxer, I used an analogy from his sport and said that I thought it was the capacity to take a punch. To my surprise and enlightenment, he responded, you got it wrong. It's not the capacity to take a punch, it's loving it. Loving the struggle, being challenged by life to hang in there and find new ways to think about and approach its problems. Proverbs 10, 17. Whoever accepts correction is on the way to life, but whoever ignores correction will lead others away from life. Now, here's the heart of the whole thing that we're talking about tonight. Proverbs 12, verse 1. Those who love knowledge want to be told when they are wrong. It is stupid to hate being corrected. Don't you wish the Bible were more complicated? Mark Twain says, what bothers me about the Bible is not the part I don't understand, it's the part I do understand. Sterling Seal wrote a book called How to Personally Profit from the Laws of Success. Listen to his observation. One of the things that often holds us back in our success is the deliberate attempt we make to hide from the facts when the facts are unpleasant. Advice is seldom valued, though there's a great deal of advising and very little listening. Usually we don't want advice, we want flattery. And yet one cannot easily be our flatterer and our friend at the same time. Let me put a little parenthesis in here and make a comment. I don't believe that. I believe that a really good friend will tell us what we need to hear. Now, I also believe that we don't have many of those. Someone said if you had six in a lifetime, you're very fortunate. You do need six. It takes that many to carry you off. So that's... A friend is somebody who will tell you when you got spinach stuck in your teeth. A friend is someone who will tell you when your deodorant has quit working. Now, that's profound. Okay, let's go back to Sterling Seal. Some people actually owe more to bitter enemies than to pleasant friends. The former sometimes speak the truth, the latter do. An enemy is often a friend in disguise who stings us into action. He tells us the truth about ourselves. Charles Spurgeon said, get a friend to tell you your faults, or better still, welcome an enemy who will watch you keenly and sting you savagely. What a blessing such an irritating critic will be to a wise man. What an intolerable nuisance to a fool. Proverbs 13, verse 18. If you ignore criticism, you'll end in poverty and disgrace. If you accept correction, you will be honored. Proverbs 15, verse 10. Harsh discipline is for him who forsakes the way, and he who hates correction will die. Bill Gates, in his book, Business is the Speed of Thought, writes, a good email system ensures that bad news can travel fast, but your people have to be willing to send you the news. You have to be constantly receptive to bad news, and then you have to act on it. Sometimes I think my most important job as CEO is to listen for bad news. If you don't act on it, your people will eventually stop bringing bad news to your attention, and that's the beginning of the end. The willingness to hear hard truth is vital, not only for CEOs of big corporations, but also for anyone who loves the truth. Sometimes the truth sounds like bad news, but it is just what we need. Isn't that powerful? Jesus said, you'll know the truth and the truth will make you free. And unless people are invited and encouraged to give it, they won't give it. Proverbs 15, verse 12. A mocker resents correction. He will not consult the wise. Let me tell you my story of when I was converted to criticism. Let me tell you how I used to like to do it when I was a younger preacher. The way I wanted to deal with criticism, if you don't like anything about me, my preaching or the way I comb my hair or anything about me, what I want you to do is speak to my good, godly elders. Because I serve under the oversight of my good, godly elders. And I want to be in subjection to my good, godly elders. So talk to my elders. So what I wanted my good godly elders to do is say, Jerry works hard and does a good job. Don't bother him. It discourages him when you criticize him. Isn't that a wonderful way to deal with it? Don't ever have to hear it that way. That's the way I enjoyed that. Well, James Jones was a marriage and family therapist who came to work in our building in Dalton, Georgia, first Monday of January of 1982. I had never talked to a counselor in my life except for saying, my name is Jerry, and he said, my name is James. And I really didn't want to. I just figured these folks were going to figure me out, and I didn't want to figure it out. Scared of it. So on that Monday, first Monday of January 1982, he was working out of the library, and my office was right across the hall. About 11 o'clock, he stepped out, and he looked at me and said, would you like to go eat lunch? Lied to him, told him I did. And so, to keep him from figuring me out, I talked constantly so he wouldn't have time to ask me any questions and figure me out. Scared me to death. Well, I finally got comfortable with him and got to talking, and one of the blessings, he rented our library for 5 hours free counseling a month to be used at the discretion of the elders, which meant that staff could set up appointments. Well, one Sunday, I gotten criticized, and it hurt my feelings. Aggravated me and a whole lot of other things. And so I went to the secretary and I said, does James have any time today? And she said, yeah, he's got 2 o'clock open. I said, I need it. And so I went in and I wanted James to do 2 things. Number one, I sure he'd do it. Number two, I didn't think he would, but I thought I might as well ask. Number one, I wanted him to agree that I was right and they were wrong, and there wasn't any question about in my mind about that. And then number two, I really hoped that someday he would visit the congregation and get around to these people and just say, well, you know, why don't you leave Jerry alone? He really does a good job, and it really discourages him when people criticize it. Didn't think he'd do it, but I thought maybe. And so I went in and told my story about how I'd gotten criticized. And I was ready for his sympathy and agreeing with me, and James just sat there and looked at the floor. As he often did. I often said he did that to stretch sessions out to make more money. Long silence. And finally, he looked at me and he said, did it ever occur to you that not everybody likes Jerry Barber? And then I didn't say anything. Because it had never occurred to me. Why wouldn't everybody like Jerry Barber? I'm an only child. Had a happy childhood. I couldn't figure why anybody wouldn't like me. So I didn't say anything. I mean, how do you answer that question? No. So after another meaningful pause, he looked at me straight in the eye and he said, not everybody likes Jerry Barber. Not everybody has liked Jerry Barber in the past. Not everybody likes Jerry Barber today. Not everybody will like Jerry Barber in the future. That's reality. That's truth. That's the way the world operates. Now, you have 2 choices. You can communicate to people that you don't want to hear that. You're not interested. You don't care what they think or feel. And if you'll communicate that real well to people, not many people will criticize you until they get ready to fire you. Man, I'd already tried that once, and that didn't work real well. I was anxious for number two, hoping this is going to be better. He said the second choice is you can let people know that you really value what they think and feel. And tell them that you would like to do that. You can invite them. Tell me what's on your mind. I'd really be interested. Please tell me. And if you communicate that real well, some people will tell you what they think, and many times it will really hurt. But you'll learn some things you will never learn any other way. And that changed my outlook toward criticism. Powerful, powerful, powerful. And so from that Monday afternoon in the early to mid-80s, I've been trying to cultivate my critics and thank them and say, please do it. Please help me any way you know you can. Point it out to me. In a book on biblical eldership by Alexander Strock, he quotes C.S. Lewis. And he's talking in this book to leaders, and it works for anyone, realizing that we have some faults in our life. He said, it is no good passing this over with some vague general admission such as, of course, I know I have my faults. It is important to realize that there's some really fatal flaw in you, something which gives the others just the same feeling of despair which their faults give you. And it is almost certainly something you don't know about. Like what the advertisements call halitosis, which everyone notices except the person who has it. Have you noticed that? Gail is my halitosis detector. And some mornings I'll go in and kiss Gail. She says, "Woo-wee, you need to do something about that breath today." I didn't know I had bad breath. I didn't say, I'm going to go out. When I was growing up, about the sixth grade, I had some fellas that moved in from North Alabama, and they caught the bus with me, and what they enjoyed during the spring is picking up wild onions and chewing them and getting on the bus and going to the girl and go, well, see, they aim to do that. I don't aim to do that. When I go out with bad breath, it's not because I say I want to blow everybody off today. Don't know it. And he said, many times there are things in our life just like, you don't know it, but other folks know it. They can smell it loud and clear, and you can't. Okay, back to him. He says, but why, you ask, don't the others tell me? If it's that way, why don't they tell? Believe me, they have tried to tell you over and over again, and you just couldn't take it. Perhaps a good deal of what you call their nagging or bad temper or queerness are just their attempts to make you see the truth. And even the faults you do know, you don't know fully. If that's right, if it's like halitosis, then I'm going to have some help. I'm going to have some help. Proverbs 15:31-32. If you listen to constructive criticism, you will be at home among the wise. If you reject discipline, you only harm yourself. But if you listen to correction, you grow in understanding. That's it, Jerry, that's it. I don't mind constructive criticism, do you? People often, now as long as it's constructive, I'll take constructive. Be sure it's constructive. You hear a little defensiveness there, as I really don't want to hear anything. Can I give you the definition of constructive and destructive criticism? This is Barber, not Bible, or Webster, either one. All right, here it is. You might want to write this down. This is a powerful definition. Constructive criticism is when I criticize you. Destructive criticism when you think I've done something wrong. See, the only way I know to do it is just let folks, just go ahead and give it to me. And God gives me the wisdom to decide. See, I don't have to take it if it doesn't belong to me. What do you do when somebody gives you a gift that's not the right size? Take it back to Walmart and change it. They'll change with you. You don't even have to have your receipt if you're going to swap it for something else. If it doesn't fit, don't wear it. But it's up to each individual to decide whether it's constructive or destructive. Proverbs 17, verse 10, a sensible person accepts correction, but you can't beat sense into a fool. Proverbs 19, 25, if you punish a mocker, the simple-minded will learn a lesson. If you correct the wise, they will be all the wiser. Now, here's what I call my Chad Hedgepath scripture, Proverbs 26, verse 2. Chad Hedgepath, with our youth minister, the day that we read Proverbs chapter 26, he said, Jerry, there's one of your criticism passages. I said, no, it's not. And he said, yes, it is. I said, no, it's not. It doesn't say anything about rebuke or correction, none of that. He said, yeah, but look what it says. Curses will not harm someone who is innocent. They are like sparrows or swallows that fly around and never land. What does that say? If you really don't deserve it, it's not going to stick. I'm pretty comfortable in the fact that I drive a brown car. Champagne, I think, is the official name for it. Let's suppose that somebody comes up after services tonight and they say, okay, Jerry, you say you like criticism, I'm going to give it to you. I think it is absolutely ridiculous and a reproach on the church for a gospel preacher to drive a purple car with yellow polka dots. And I think you need to get your car painted. I don't like the way your car looks. A purple car with yellow polka dots. Now, you think I'm going to get all upset and lose a lot of sleep over that? No. I got a brown car. I might say, well, what do you think about the interior? See, a curse that you don't deserve won't light. Either there's some truth in it, or I may have the false belief that everybody ought to like me and compliment me all the time. Russell Lyons says the only graceful way to accept an insult is to ignore it. If you can't ignore it, top it. If you can't top it, laugh at it. If you can't laugh at it, it's probably deserved. Proverbs 27, 5, 6, and 17. Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. As iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friends. Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. What do you do with anonymous criticism? What do you do with anonymous letters? I'll be talking more about this as we get into another series here in a few weeks, but I preached for Barry's Chapel for 14 years. When I went there, I started studying their history, and here was their history. For a decade before I came, they had a fuss every 2 years. There was a fuss of 86, fuss of 88, fuss of 90, fuss of 92. I went in 93, we had the fuss of 95. And during the fuss of 95, we appointed four new elders who had never served as elders in their life. They were overwhelmed. We had just been through the fuss of 95. And they said, here's what we're going to do for 1 year. For 1 year, we're going to study what the Bible says about elders and what we're supposed to be doing. And number two, we're going to try to learn how to get along with each other. That's our two projects. And so it was an adventure being with those four men that year, because every time something new would come up, they'd say, what are we going to do about it? They didn't have any precedent. They didn't have anybody to ask. How do y'all handle this? And so in April of 96, they and I and five other members of the Barry's Chapel Church received the following letter, unsigned. To the good brethren of Barry's Chapel, for too long I've sat and observed the destruction of this congregation because of personal opinions and desires being placed over the will of God. This church has split several times in its history, whether we want to admit it or not. In all those cases, it was because of personal desires of a few. Well, events over the recent period of time have made me realize it is time to implement an eye for an eye. The comments to follow will be embarrassing to some, but the facts are true and cannot be disputed. It is time for hypocrisy to stop, and this appears to be the most appropriate method. This letter will be sent to the four elders, the minister, and five families selected from the most recent directory. It will be mailed to all those listed in the most recent directory if immediate changes are not made. You have been judged, now you must be judged. Jerry Barber has done more to destroy this church than most other people. I believe the membership has dropped from the 450 Glenn Randolph helped us to grow to about 300 at the present and still shrinking. From the pulpit, Jerry is boring and does not present us with any spiritual growth or challenges. He is unfriendly and uncaring, as you proved by firing the church secretary. Jerry, have you observed your audience? Most are asleep and those awake are not listening. You're too rehearsed and you're not genuine. Very few people that know you respect you, but as you know, this is consistent with other places you have preached. Why do so many people celebrate when you're finally asked to leave? According to the elders at other congregations, you have done the same thing to Barry's Chapel as you have to other congregations. More specifics will be included in the next letter. After that, he got nasty. I mean, really, really, really. He started in on the elders, and he insulted their wives and their kids, and it was bad. And so the elders said, what are we going to do? We've never dealt with an anonymous letter. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And they decided not to do anything. How do you respond to an anonymous letter? Who are you going to respond to? If you get up and put on a show, all you got to do, every time you want to see the elders put on a show, is write an anonymous letter, and they get up and perform. Let me tell you something interesting about this. Let me make two or three observations. Number one, I don't think anonymous letters is a good way to communicate. However, I'll give you some advice if you want it. If you want to write an anonymous letter and get by with it, not be discovered, get somebody else to write it for you. Because people write the same way they talk, and every one of us to a person said, that's who did it. That's just the way he talks. Held a meeting down in the southern part of Middle Tennessee several years ago, right after I'd moved to Nashville. A lady wrote me a 3-page letter on how disappointed she was that I moved to Nashville, Tennessee. She said, I don't understand how a good, sound gospel preacher would move to Nashville, Tennessee with all the stuff that's going on in the church there. I didn't think you'd do something like that. And she went on and on for 3 pages. And then at the bottom, she said, just sign me anonymous. However, probably by habit, she put her name and return address on the envelope. Let me tell you something else interesting. This was written by a progressive, by someone who believes in grace and mercy. You know what I'm talking about. Y'all probably don't have those up here in Cookeville, but we had them back at Barry's Chapel. You know, the more progressive people. Just because a person claims to be full of grace and mercy and truth doesn't mean they're not mean as a snake sometimes. Oh, so you're saying that all the conservatives are good people. Now let me read you the ones the conservatives sent to me. Here's the one from their side of the house. What they did is sent me the page out of the classified ads of a gospel paper, people looking for preachers. And here's what it says. We cannot understand your preaching. It is too vague. What are you against? What are you for? Be specific. You see, Christians want preachers who specifically state and know in certain terms that they are conservative. We do not send these classifieds to you to insinuate that you should look elsewhere for work, but to show you what Christians want. Others throughout the U.S. want preachers who are sound in their teachings. We are unsure of your teachings. They leave us confused, frustrated, and fearful that we are participating in worship and works that are foreign to God. Be firm and tell us what you believe. We do not sign our names this time for fear of retribution because we do not trust where you stand in Christian love. All right, the elders talked about it. What we're going to do, what we're going to do with anonymous letters. Here's what they decided. We're not going to do anything about anonymous letters. That was their policy. And so they never did. Let me define Jerry Barber. Mine is slightly different from the elders at Barry's Chapel. Here is my policy about responding to anonymous letters. I do not respond to anonymous letters unless they have money in them. Let me explain. Probably about 95, I was going down to Lewisburg, Tennessee one night to speak at Vacation Bible School, and it was before cell phones, before I had a cell phone, and my pager went off, and I had plenty of time, so I pulled over to a payphone, called Gail. I said, what's going on? She said, who do we know in Cincinnati, Ohio, whose last name is Moose? And I said, I don't know anybody in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I don't know anybody whose last name is Moose. Why? She said, well, we got this unusual letter today from somebody in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I've called the operator trying to find the phone number and call them, but I can't find the phone number. I said, well, tell me more about it. She said, well, it's real weird. I said, there's an envelope, and it has a $200 postal money order in it, made out to you. And then it has a posted note that says, for all you do in him, and it's signed, a non E. Moose. And she said, I've called the operator and can't find his phone number. I said, Gail, say it real fast. A nonny moose. Well, I felt kind of funny. I went to the bank and I said, I've never gotten a letter like this before. Is this worth anything? I said, yeah, it's a postal money order. It's worth $200. I said, okay, deposit it. There was a street address in Cincinnati, Ohio, so I wrote them a thank you note and wrote a bulletin article about it. I'll do a lot for $200. About 6 months went by, and I got another one. This time it was from East Ellijay, Georgia. Wrote them a thank you note, and it didn't come back, so evidently somebody got it out of the mailbox. A few months went by and got one from California. Wrote another thank you note. A few months went by and got one this time from Nashville, Tennessee. Wrote another thank you note. So, if you would like to write me an anonymous letter, and if you would like a reply, if you'll give me a street address or a post office box number, I'll be glad to write you a thank you note. Otherwise, I don't respond to anonymous letters. Young preacher called me from Kentucky some time ago, and he said, Jerry, I don't know what to do. He said, the elders called me in. We were talking, and they said, you're not paying enough attention to a few families in the church. He said, well, I really appreciate you telling me that. Who are they? They said, we can't tell you. It's confidential. He said, well, what am I supposed to do about it? He said, well, you need to pay more attention to these people because they're feeling rejected. He said, well, okay, who are they? They said, we can't tell you. It's confidential. He said, what am I supposed to do? Absolutely nothing. You can't do it. You can't do it. You can't do it. And so I've talked with our elders here. I don't accept anonymous criticism. If you want to tell me something, I love it. I appreciate it. I'll listen to it. But they say, and some said, and a whole bunch said, really doesn't communicate. I really value what you think and what you feel, and I'll listen to it. Proverbs 29, verse 1. If you get more stubborn every time you're corrected, one day you'll be crushed and never recover. Again, my friend Edwin Friedman, he said much of the criticism directed at spiritual leaders is henpecking, pure and simple. It can never be made to go away permanently by trying harder to please. Despite the time bomb quality of the emotionality, it is usually rather harmless in itself and will tend to self-destruct if there's no defensive feedback to keep it ticking. What that means, it takes two to fuss. If you'll just listen, probably not much is going to come from it. Proverbs 29, verse 11, a fool always loses his temper, but a wise man holds it back. Kenneth Joins told about being in class at Lipscomb with Brother Carol Ellis. He said one day, Brother Ellis said, you know, if a man's going down Belmont Avenue with one of these sandwich plates, sandwich signs on his front and back, and it says, Carol Ellis is a nut, a few people will believe him. Now, he said, if I start walking up and down Belmont Avenue right behind him with one of these signs and it says, Carol Ellis is not a nut, about everybody will believe it. So we have to decide how we're going to respond to criticism. We have some choices. But next to James Jones's session, the counselor who talked to me on that Monday afternoon, here's the second most influential piece of wisdom that I've ever received on criticism. This is by Peter Steinke and How Your Church Family Works, page 89. Listen to what he says about criticism. By far the most difficult form of pursuit behavior to recognize is criticism. How can those who act adversarially be said to be in pursuit? We feel alienated, not close. But criticism is characterized by overfocus. The stinger and the stung are emotionally connected. Whenever an annoying critic gets inside our brain cells and we can't expunge him, we are connected even if negatively. Whenever someone gets under our skin, we are infected with anxiety. If we are reactive to a pursuer, the pursuit behavior achieves its goal, connection. Strange as it sounds, the critic wants to be close. After all, if we can't be close through play, ecstasy, touch, and nurture, our only option to accomplish closeness is through angry outbursts, specious charges, or harsh accusations. People feel close to us when they know we are thinking about them. What we think is not as important as that we are thinking about them. We play into the hands of criticizers when we react to their invasion rather than define ourselves to it. Isn't that powerful? When I have couples come in, and I'm not a counselor, don't have any license and none of that, but I listen to folks sometimes, and when I have a couple, guess what's the first thing I do? State the rules, okay? So we talk about what we say here stays here, talk one time, have a right to all of our feelings, be mad, sad, glad, scared, or any of those. And we define all those, and it takes usually two or three sessions for them to believe it's really okay to say what to think. And many times, if they're in severe conflict, they will explode about the second or third session. And I've had people shake their fist at each other and say some words I wouldn't repeat in the pulpit. And rather than getting all upset, when I was at Barry's Chapel, I had a Cracker Barrel rocker where I did my counseling. And I just kind of rock and just kind of wait and let them run down. I said, man, I am encouraged. This is probably the best session we've had so far. I really have hope for you all. Y'all really love each other, don't you? They said, what are you talking about? I said, oh, y'all love each other. See, the opposite of love is not hatred. The opposite of love is indifference. I'd a lot of other people be bursting out at each other than what I've had happen too many times. Jerry, I just don't care. I don't care what you think. I don't care what you feel. I just don't care. That's tough. And so what I tell couples like that, what I'd like to do, don't you ever want to quit fussing. I'd like to be your fussing coach. I want to help you fuss better. And let's find some ways to talk about how to fuss fair and see if we can get that going a lot better. All righty. That's the meat. Let's get the bottom slice of bread and a few comments and we'll be through. From the book of Ecclesiastes, we get the bottom slice of bread for our criticism sandwich. It's better to go to a funeral than to a party. We all must die and everyone living should think about this. Sorrow is better than laughter, and sadness has a good influence on you. A wise person thinks about death, but a fool thinks only about having a good time. It is better to be criticized by a wise person than to be praised by a fool. The laughter of fools is like the crackling of thorns in a cooking fire. Both are useless. One of the things that's saying is, pain is sometimes very constructive. And so the fact that criticism hurts doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it hurts. And I need to evaluate that. Fred Smith was one of the most popular writers in Leadership Magazine while he was alive. And he writes this on the care and feeding of critics. He says, therefore, the leader must expect criticism, much as an Olympian would expect and plan for pain. Let me stop right there a minute. I believe that leaders invite criticism. The very fact that you and I are leaders, we invite criticism. We're lightning rods, not throw rugs. What's a lightning rod do? It attracts lightning. It says, come here, hit me, hit me, hit me. I'm going to stand up higher than anybody else. Hit me, and I tell you what I'll do. I'll ground that and protect the structure. That's what lightning rods are for. And so it's going to happen. We expect that. He said, I listened to Bob Richards, the Olympic gold medalist, interview younger Olympic winners of the gold. He asked them, what did you do when you began to hurt? None of these Olympians were surprised by the question. All had a specific way of handling the pain. Some even prayed. After the interview, I asked Bob why he had asked about handling pain, and he said, matter-of-factly, you never win the gold without hurting. Now, let me make a suggestion. If you picked up a mustard seed tonight and you think this is a pretty good idea, that criticism is really good, let me tell you how to apply this lesson. Apply it to yourself, not somebody else. You apply it to yourself, not to your husband or wife. You apply it to yourself, not to the elders, unless you happen to be the elder that you're applying it to. If you're an elder, you apply it to yourself and not to the congregation. You apply it to yourself. You don't say, boy, I like that. Jerry said criticism is good. I don't want to criticize you. No. Say, hey, tell me what you think. I really want to know. And probably folks will doubt that for a while. And then they'll give you a tryout. You know, we talk about preachers trying out. I'm convinced that we try out over and over again. People will give us just a little to see how we'll handle it. And if we don't do our tryout real well, they won't give us any more. And so let's experiment with that. Criticism can always be a blessing. It's an opportunity to learn. Here's one of the things I started doing after my Monday afternoon session with my friend James Jones. I started each year when I was in full-time work having a Sunday night where we called it, What Do You Think About the Preacher? And it was a night where I invited people to criticize me. And incidentally, our first night for that here at College Side will be Sunday night, June the 20th, our next family meeting. I want you to criticize me. I want to know what you think. And here's some good news. You don't have to wait till then to do it. You can do it tonight, or you can call me on the telephone, write me a letter and sign it. Let's go to lunch, or just drop by and let's chat. I really am interested in what you think. But I started doing this one Sunday night a year, and I said, I get to preach to you all year long, and this is your night to preach to me. Guess what's the first thing I do when I have that session? Set structure. Speak one at a time. Speak for yourself. You speak for you, I speak for me. Let God speak for God. Don't speak for everybody else, but tell me what you think. And it's been one of the greatest blessings of my ministry. Learn some just neat things. And what happens is folks get to talk to each other instead of just talking to me. It's been one. I promise to do three things. Number one, I will listen. Number two, I will write it down. Number three, I will think about it. That's my three commitments. I remember at one church we were having it, and Leroy sat right over here, lived two doors down from me, one of our deacons, one of my neighbors. He said, Jerry, I think you know that most people, you know a lot about psychology and the way people think. I think you know that people can't listen but about 16 and a half or 17 minutes at a time. I said, Leroy, it sounds like what you're saying is I preach too long. He said, you got it. I said, thank you for getting us started off tonight. And I wrote that down. Brother Harlan Roark was sitting right back here. He said, I'll tell you one thing. If you ain't going to talk no longer than that, I ain't going to get dressed up and drive in from Pegram. Isn't that powerful? Powerful. First one we had at Barry's Chapel. Young lady right over here said, Jerry, I don't like your series. I hate your series. You preach series after series of things, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. I said, thank you for getting us started off tonight. Channing Workman held his hand up and said, Jerry, I've been thinking and praying about this, and I really think what we need at Barry's Chapel is a good series of sermons on forgiveness. Isn't that neat? So I got to jogging. I do some of my best Bible study when I'm jogging. I thought about it. And so from then on, I preached series at Barry's Chapel pretty well all the time, but when I would preach a series, I'd preach the sermons once a month instead of week after week after week. And so I preached a series on the life of Christ, 12 lessons, but I did it one in January, one in February, and so forth. One of the neatest things ever happened to me, I get to study the subject longer and just seems to work real well. One lady said, Jerry, I'd really like to speak to you some Sunday mornings after you preach, but you always stand back there. I always go out this door and I forget by the time I see you the next time. I'd like to tell you you did a good job. There's nowhere in the Bible says you have to stand at that door every time. So I started standing out there on Sunday mornings, first and third Sunday nights. I'd stand at this door, second and fourth at this door. Isn't that wonderful? You just learn things you never learn any other way. So be thinking about what you're going to criticize on the 20th of June, and if you got something before then be sure and do that. Also, it is an opportunity to minister. It's powerful what we do if we don't get too reactive. I don't always do it right. Here's a time that God was with me. Here's what we started with tonight. Our preacher is too young, too immature, too trite. I get nothing from his services, and now he is my Sunday school teacher too. That was the front of the card. Here's the back of the card. I hate everything and everybody. When I hear someone laugh, I want to hit them. Why should they have something to laugh about when I don't? Any of you familiar with Barbara Johnson? Stick a geranium in your hat and be happy, and some other books like that. Barbara Johnson ran what she called Spatula Ministries. It's for scraping parents off the ceiling whose children have run them up the wall. And if I had time, I could tell you a lot about the hurt that went into the life of Barbara Johnson to help her produce such terrific books. But here's my mustard seed from Barbara Johnson. Here it is. Read several of her books. She says, hurt people hurt people. And so when somebody is vicious, one good trial idea to put in your mind, that person is really hurting. Okay? I received that in November 1977. About 7 years went by. And one day I was in my office in Dalton, Georgia, and an older lady came in, and she was weeping and weeping and weeping and weeping and weeping. And she cried and she cried and she cried. And when she finally got composure, she said, Jerry, I don't know what I'm going to do. I feel so bad. I feel so guilty, and I don't know what to do. She said, I know that good Christian people don't have mental illness in their family. And I feel so bad. And she would cry and cry. She said, I know good Christian people don't have mental illness in their family, but I'm going to have to put my daughter in the hospital for mental illness. This was her daughter who wrote this in November of 1977. And she said, I don't know what to do. I said, could I share with you some information about my family? She said, yeah. I said, okay, let me tell you a little bit about my family. On my daddy's side, my daddy's daddy, my granddaddy, spent most of his adult life in Central State Hospital on Murfreesboro Road in Nashville, Tennessee. I only remember seeing him one time at home in my life. The rest of the time we visited him in the hospital. My daddy's only brother was in Central State Hospital for years. He went 6 years one time and nobody heard him say a word. No doctor, nurse, or relative heard him say anything. Daddy had a sister who went through shock treatment for a nervous breakdown. On my mother's side of the family, my granddaddy committed suicide. I had a first cousin who committed suicide. I had an uncle who committed suicide. My mother had two sisters who took shock treatment about every 10 years. She said, Brother Jerry, I thought you were a good Christian. I said, by the grace of God, I think that's right. She said, I never realized that good Christians could have mental illness in their family. See, sometimes we're just kind of listening. We're more alike than different. And as Miss Johnson said, hurt people hurt people. Criticism may be slightly more tolerable than a root canal, but that doesn't mean you should avoid it. In fact, we should invite it. Criticism is the breakfast of champions. Harold Hazlitt quoted Charles Reynolds Brown when he said, the man who does not know and does not know that he does not know and is not willing that anyone should tell him that he does not know had better not enter the ministry. He had better raise sweet potatoes.